Benjamin Graham, the intelligent investor, 1949, said, "The investor with a portfolio of sound stocks should expect their prices to fluctuate and should neither be concerned by sizable declines nor become excited by sizable advances. He should always remember that market quotations are there for his convenience, either to be taken advantage of or to be ignored." Money Machine, Show 94, Early January. Hello, everyone. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome back to the Mad Money Machine, Show 94. It's so good to have you subscribed to my feed. Thank you very much for listening. The Mad Money Machine is very, very, very proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors. Go check them out on the web at ifa.com and get Mark Hebner's book, Index Funds, the 12-Step Program for Active Investors. We'll be talking about the 12 steps all over again starting today. Well, how is your stock portfolio doing so far in 2008? Probably, if you are in stocks, not very well, unless you're in gold stocks or something. I don't know. Remember that show I did on a dynamically adjusted risk capacity? Well, in fact, that happened in real life for me because my wife changed jobs. We rolled over her 401k into an IRA, and I just put it all in cash at that moment. And it has been in cash ever since, and boy, am I lucky. Oh, I know, you're jealous. Well, I talked about 10 predictions on a previous show. Two of them have come true. Commodities are in vogue again. Gold hit a new all-time high, $880. That's the highest price that gold has ever been for an ounce. Of course, that is not inflation adjusted. And if you were to apparently adjust the price of gold for inflation going back to 1980s, it would be something like $2,100 an ounce back then. So we've got a ways to go. And I also updated then my prediction for gold. It might hit $1,000 by the end of the year. And of course, you know what the value of predictions is, nothing. So pay no attention to that one either. And while we're on the subject of commodities, did you go out to coinflation.com that I mentioned in a previous show? If you did, you'll see that now a penny between one of the old pennies between 1909 and 1982, those pennies are made of 95% copper. And the metal value in a penny is now 2 cents, 2.16 cents, for example. And also nickels, all the way to 2008, I guess current nickels. You know how much they're worth? They're worth 6.23 cents. So go buy a roll of nickels and you'll have an instant 24% gain on your investment. Now, of course, it's illegal to melt down nickels for their nickel value. But someday you'll probably be able to sell them on eBay. My other prediction was that Ron Paul would do better than expected. He did do better than expected in Iowa by a tiny margin. And I think didn't do as well as a lot of Ron Paul supporters did expect in New Hampshire, although the polls were apparently right on the money. They said he would come in with 8%, and he got about 8%. And despite the fact that they had a lot of supporters come in from out of state to try to get out the vote for Ron Paul, I guess the weather didn't cooperate. I think Ron Paul would have wished a big ice storm would have hit so that only the absolute diehard voters would have gone out. But instead, it looked like a record turnout for New Hampshire. And by the way, what is all this talk about Hillary beating Obama in New Hampshire? If I was Obama, wouldn't I be upset about that kind of talk? I mean, they both got 9 delegates out of New Hampshire. And the delegates are what matters. The popular vote really doesn't matter that much. What is the fascination by the popular vote count when what really matters is the delegates? It's just crazy. Let's see, what else we got on this show? The Boglehead Contest is going on. I'll have a link in the show notes out at the Boglehead Forums, diehards.org/forums. Or is it forum? I never can get it straight. There's a game to predict the close of the S&P 500 by the end of the year. I'm not sure if this game has an ending date or not. I guess you can go look, but I have a link to it in the show notes. My prediction, I said, now at the time I made my prediction, which was just a few days ago, I predicted that the S&P would be down 5% from that point for the year, and so that meant a closing price of 1393.65. Well, right now it's at 1409.15, and see, I'm thinking that the market is going to go down in the beginning of the year and then come back up generally at the end of the year, but I don't think it'll, my prediction is that it would not quite come back up to where it started. Again, take predictions for what they're worth, and that is nothing. Just for fun. Let's pull something out of the tool crib. Well, most all the tools I've given you so far have been free tools, mostly websites and things. This week's tool in the crib is a tool that it's actually something that my wife got me for Christmas, and I wanted to talk about it on this show. It is the Amazon Kindle electronic book reader. I had mentioned it to her before Christmas, talked about what it did, and wouldn't you know, it shows up under the Christmas tree this year. And what is this thing, then? It is a electronic book reading device. It is certainly a lot smaller than a laptop, but it's bigger than an iPhone. It's about as big as a paperback book, they say, and not very thick. It has a different kind of display on it, though. It's pure black and white with shades of gray, and it uses e-ink, electronic ink, instead of the LCD display. And the thing about e-ink is that it displays its page of information, it doesn't need any more power. So it can sit on a particular page that you're looking at for hours on end and apparently not draw any or significant amount of battery power. Therefore, you can read books on this thing without a recharge for a long, 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 long time. And so where do you get books from? Two places, at least. One is you can buy them. You can go onto Amazon in your account. You can find a book that has the ability to be loaded onto your Kindle and say buy it. And it will automatically then show up on your Kindle device because the Kindle has a cell phone connection in it. I can't remember if it's EVDO. I think it is. But you don't even need an account with a cellular provider for this thing to work. And that is absolutely amazing to me. And the second way to get books then is if you have a book in a PDF format or if there's some free book. In fact, I'll have a link on the show notes to this show to a website that has free public domain books that are in a format compatible with Kindle. For example, Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations is available as a free ebook. Or you can take any PDF file and you can email it to your account at free.kindle.com. And the folks at Amazon then automatically convert that to a format file that can be loaded onto your Kindle then. And I have done this for several books in PDF form. In fact, I've yet to buy a book for the Kindle. I did buy one day of Wall Street Journal just to try to compare whether I thought getting the newspaper on the Kindle would be effective or not. And because they don't have the graphics and things in the newspaper, I think it's better just to read it online, quite frankly, on the computer rather than on the Kindle. But it would be good to get rid of all that newsprint and papers. But I mentioned this thing does have built-in connectivity. And what you can do then is you can go to the home page on this Kindle device by hitting a little home icon. If you click the right button there, you can get to a place where they have an experimental, they call it, web browser built into this thing. And it will let you surf the internet straight from this device. And it's amazing because you don't pay another nickel for this service. You buy the device. Now, admittedly, it's $400. But you buy the device and there are no connectivity charges. How's that going to happen? That's amazing. I guess Amazon is really counting on you buying some books for this thing. Of course, you need content on it. But you can use it as an internet surfing device at the moment. We'll see if they take away the browser functionality or not. Hopefully not. because you can get to services like the BBC's news website. You can get to the Weather Channel pages, Weather Underground. You can get to MSNBC page. In fact, you get to any page on the internet, but they have some already built in. And supposedly, you can even get to Google Maps. And supposedly, you can even press Alt-1, and it will show you on the map where you are. How's that? Well, there's a lot of neat things that I'm looking forward to discovering on the Amazon Kindle. If you'd like to discover things on the Amazon Kindle, go to madmanmachine.com, and in the show notes of this show, click on that picture of the Kindle, and you can run out to Amazon and buy a copy for yourself. And did I mention it can also play music? Well, that's the tool this time, the Amazon Kindle ebook reader. And unlike all the tools I've given you mostly, this one is expensive. I am chomping at the bit to get out to you the Lazy Portfolio SmackDown results for the year 2007. Remember, I've been keeping track of some of the head guys who make up Lazy Portfolios. For example, David Swinson, the Coffee House Investor, Scott Burns, Ben Stein. All kinds of guys have Lazy Portfolios. And I, for the past couple of quarters, have kept track of their performance through 2007. Well, the thing about it is the stock market functions tool that I use to get historical quotes from Yahoo pulls those quotes out nicely from Yahoo, but the problem is Yahoo hasn't updated their historical quotes to include all the December dividends that these various mutual funds have paid. Now, I could go in manually and adjust the prices to reflect the dividends paid, but guess what? I'm lazy. This is the Lazy Portfolio SmackDown, and I am too lazy to calculate all that stuff up by hand. I hope you don't blame me. So as soon as Yahoo gets the dividends put into these various mutual funds, I'll report it to you. Keep checking the website. I'll put it on the website as soon as I have it, and then talk about it on the show. Now, the last show I talked about the Board of Directors Portfolio SmackDown performance. Well, there was another Portfolio SmackDown game that I ran out at MarketWatch at the VSE, the Virtual Stock Exchange. It was the public Madman Machine Portfolio SmackDown, and we had something like 960 people or accounts sign up to play in that game. Now, admittedly, there were a swath of them that never made a single trade. Well, here's what I did. I actually went into VSE and I copied each and every one of those entries into a spreadsheet. This was kind of laborious because it would only do 30 at a time. So you can imagine out of 960, I had to do a lot of page down, copy, select, paste, and so forth. But I did it for you. Guess I'm not that lazy after all, am I? I put it into a spreadsheet. I removed all of those whose balance was $100,000 exactly, because that shows they didn't do any trades. And then I computed the average. And what do you think the average of all the stock pickers was for 2007? It was up 5.3%. Now compare that to the Vanguard Total Stock Market Exchange Traded Fund, ticker symbol VTI. What did it do in 2007? It was up 5.3%, exactly the same as all the stock pickers. Of course, admittedly, there were some stock pickers that had something like 300 to 500% gains, and there was some stock pickers that had, minus 94% losses. But it was interesting that the average of all of them was exactly the same as the Vanguard Total Stock Market Exchange Traded Fund. Year, a brand new month, and a brand new step. Step one of the 12 steps for active investors. Step one is active investors. In the book, The 12-Step Program for Active Investors, Mark Hebner defines what an active investor is And then he compares it with index funds investors. Talks about the concept of beating the market. Talks about risk measurements. And then describes why active investors lose. And at the end, he's got a little quiz. You want to take it? Here it is, real quickly. Five questions. Ready? See how many you can get right. Multiple choice. Number one. Investment managers of index funds engage in A, stock picking, B, market timing, C, manager picking, D, analytical techniques best described as speculative, or E, analytical techniques best described as scientific. Answer was E, analytical techniques best described as scientific. Question two. A Dalbar study showed that the average investor earned $19,625 on a $100,000 investment over a 20-year period, while the S&P 500 gained A, $15,000, B, $38,000, C, $356,000, D, $400,000, or E, $591,000. All right, you got the idea here. An investor put $100,000 in the market. 20 years later, they made $19,000+. How much did the S&P make, though? 15, 38, 356, 400, or 591? The answer is D, $400,938. Question three. In a 1997 letter to shareholders, Warren Buffett stated, quote, "The best way to own common stocks is A, to own Berkshire Hathaway, his own company, B, to have your broker pick 10 growth stocks, C, to buy at the bottom of the market and sell at the top, or D, to own an index fund that charges minimal fees." The answer is D, to own an index fund that charges minimal fees. Warren Buffett is a big proponent of owning index funds.
If you take the low-cost index funds, they are getting costs down to a minimum. And in a sense, you own a cross-section of America at a very, very low cost. And you'll get a good result with that unless you panic at the wrong time or something of the sort. If you just stick with it for decades, you'll do fine.
Question four. When 1,555 investors were given a test of 20 basic questions in the year 2000 regarding investing, the average score of these 1,555 investors was what? A, none, B, 37%, C, 60%, or D, 95%? The answer is B, 37% of the people got basic questions on investing correct. Question five. PricewaterhouseCoopers found that one of the largest obstacles warding off investors from investing into index funds was A, the high management fees of index funds, B, the emotional drive, desire, or need to beat the market, C, the below market performance of index funds, D, the difficulty in finding an index manager, or E, the high taxes generated by index funds. Your answer? It's B. The largest obstacles warding off investors from investing in index funds was the emotional drive, the desire or need to beat the market. All the other questions were false. There are not high management fees of index funds. Index funds are not below market performance. They are market performance. There are plenty of index fund managers out there, and index funds do not generate high taxes. How many did you get right? Hopefully all five. Well, I've got the Fox Business Channel over here on to my right, muted, and I keep watching it, and I see Steve Forbes' face popping up on it. He is... I guess he has sold to the Giuliani campaign his flat tax proposal. And so the flat tax is going to be an issue in this presidential campaign as well. Oh, boy. Good luck on ever getting anything done. The funny thing is, Rudy says his is the biggest tax cut of them all. The funny thing is, nobody mentions Ron Paul's proposed tax cut, and that is zero taxes. I like that plan. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 94 is Henry Hazlitt. Henry Hazlitt, or is it Hazlitt, born November 28th, 1894, and passed July 8th, 1993, was a philosopher, economist, and journalist for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Newsweek, among other publications. He's well known for his book, Economics in One Lesson. And I have an email from Adam Hook, who says that he would highly recommend that I listen to the audiobook of Henry Hazlitt, Economics in One Lesson. But he also says, Paul, would you keep in mind that all the gains in the stock markets are based on inflation and reinvested dividends? All the money in the world currently is all the money that there will ever be. All right. Appreciate the tip-off, Adam, nonetheless, to Henry Hazlitt. I'll just alternate in pronunciations. Well, the book is Economics in One Lesson. And in the very first chapter, he talks about the lesson. He says, economics is haunted by more fallacies than any other study known to man. He talks about people having self-interests when it comes to economics, but there's a persistent tendency of men to see only the immediate effects of a given policy or its effects only on a special group, and to neglect to inquire what the long-run effects of that policy will be, not only on that special group, but on all groups. It's the fallacy of overlooking secondary consequences, which I think in today's terminology is the unintended consequences. In this lies the whole difference between good economics and bad. And summarizing in his last sentence in this says, from this aspect, therefore, the whole of economics can be reduced to a single lesson, and that lesson can be reduced to a single sentence, and that sentence is this: the art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. He goes on to say that 9/10 of the economic fallacies that are working such dreadful harm in the world today are the result of ignoring this lesson. Now, in chapter 2, he has an illustration. He calls it the broken window. He talks about a young hoodlum, say, who heaves a brick through the window of a baker's shop. The shopkeeper runs out, furious, but the boy is gone. A crowd gathers and begins to stare with quiet satisfaction at the gaping hole in the window and the shattered glass over the bread and pies. And after a while, the crowd feels the need for philosophic reflection. And they begin thinking about, well, let's see, now the baker's going to have to replace the window. And with that money, the glazier will be able to take that money then and be able to spend it on other things. And the logical conclusion to all this is the hoodlum who threw the brick, far from being a public menace, was being a public benefactor. He created work for this glazier, person who puts in the glass. And then the person who puts in the glass buys stuff from. Ah, but Hazlitt says, now let's take another look. The crowd is at least right in the first conclusion. It will mean more business for some. But the shopkeeper will be out the money that he was planning to spend, say, on a new suit. Because he has to replace the window, he will have to go without the suit. And so the tailor, in this case, has lost his business to the glazier. No new employment has been added. The people in the crowd were only thinking of two parties in the transaction, the baker and the glazier. They had forgotten about the potential third party, the tailor. And then Hazlitt continues in the next session, talking about the blessings of destruction, and he talks about it on a much grander scale. What about if we have a war? Just imagine all the companies that will profit by all the gearing up to fight the war. Well, you can actually read this book online on the web, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes for this show. Economics in One Lesson. Congratulations, Henry Hazlett. You're the guru on Mad Men Machine Show 94. You know what? I know you like Guru Roulette. So let's play again. Spin that wheel one more time on the Mad Men Machine Show 94. And the winner is Eugene Fama. Ah, he was a winner once before on the Mad Men Machine. Well, he has come up again on the roulette wheel. Few economists have had greater influence on financial history and practice than Eugene Fama. His 1964 doctoral dissertation, The Behavior of Stock Market Prices, suggested that stock markets are efficient. Because of competition among investors, company share prices must respond swiftly to past events, current information, and future expectations. Actual prices are good estimates of intrinsic value, therefore, and no analyst can find consistent, profitable anomalies. And price trends are random, said Fama. Past patterns don't predict future directions. In a non-technical article a year later, his research popularized the efficient market hypothesis. Well, there is an interview with Eugene Fama at a website, Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis or something. And one of the interesting questions they asked Eugene Fama was about momentum. They said, let me ask you about momentum. You've said that it's the strongest challenge to the hypothesis of market efficiency. Can you elaborate on that? And Fama said, there's evidence that if you rank stocks every month based on their last year of returns, the very extreme winners tend to win for a few more months, and the losers tend to lose for a few more months. That seems to be true in U.S. data beginning around 1950. We don't have foreign data going back that far, but it tends to be there in major foreign markets except for Japan. It doesn't tend to be there in the U.S. data for the 30s and 40s. So there's some chance that it's just a chance result. There are also many people looking for anomalies in the data. That may just be the biggest one that they've found. Maybe it won't be there in the future. We just don't know. And then they asked him, is there an opportunity to make money there? Fama said, well, there isn't much of an opportunity to make money because, as I said, you do this every month. And if you rank and trade stocks every month, the turnover of these portfolios is enormous. The costs will eat up the profits, they asked. Fama said, right. The cost will kill you. So the people who have written these papers had said, basically, this is interesting, but forget about trading on it. But it's still interesting. And they go on to talk about housing markets, credit markets, new financial technologies, equity premium, on and on and on. And it's an interesting interview. I'll have a link to it in the show notes for this show. Congratulations, Gene Fama. You're the bonus guru on Mad Men Machine Show 94. Let's play again. It's Gurus Gone Gaga on the Mad Men Machine Show 94. And the winner this time on the Mad Men Machine Show 94 is Jonathan Clements. Well, Jonathan Clements writes an article for the Wall Street Journal, Getting Going. I think it comes out every Wednesday, and it's all about good stuff for your portfolios. On December 19th, he had an article entitled, These Wild and Crazy ETFs Could Help Tame Your Portfolio. And he talks about four key sectors offering ordinary investors some great new ways to diversify. And the four key sectors that he talks about are foreign real estate, international small caps, commodities, and foreign bonds. I'll have a link in the show notes to this article. In foreign real estate, for example, he talks about REITs for the U.S., but now there's some real estate funds that are international. And international small caps. Among international small cap funds, these are some good options, but many are closed to new investors, he says. Now there's a handful of ETFs, like the iShares MSCI EAFE Small Cap and the WisdomTree International Small Cap, ticker symbol DLS, I remember on that one. And the commodities funds, he talks about a iShares S&P GSCI Commodity, a PowerShares DB Commodity, and the iPath Dow Jones AIG commodity. And I also know that Jim Rogers has a commodity fund. It's an ETN, though. And I've promised to talk about ETNs sometime. I will in the future. The thing about them is they're only backed by the company issuing the ETN, not by the underlying asset. So be careful. And foreign bonds, the PDR Lehman International Treasury Bond is an 11-week-old ETF, he said, that charges 0.5% in annual expenses. Intrigued, he says. Remember, we're talking about volatile investments. My advice, don't stash more than 10% of your total portfolio in any of the funds mentioned above. In fact, a 5% allocation is probably plenty. Congratulations, Jonathan Clements. You're the guru. You're the double bonus guru on Mad Men Machine Show 94. There is a particularly good Econ Talk podcast this week, January 7th. Russ Roberts talks to Edward Castronova on the exodus to the virtual world. Edward Castronova is of Indiana University and author of that book. He talks about his provocative thesis that a growing number of people around the world will be spending more and more time playing online multiplayer games in virtual reality, both as a form of escape and as a search for meaning. It's a really good podcast. I recommend you download that. Coming up on the Mad Money Machine, I will be talking a little bit more about the games I've been playing, Rock Band and Half-Life 2 from the Orange Box. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes gurus gone gaga to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next week. In the meantime, visit our sponsor at Index Funds Advisors, IFA.com on the web. Take their risk capacity survey. Please do yourself a favor and take their risk capacity survey. At the end, they will ask you for your email address, but don't be shy about doing that. They won't spam you to death. You will want the results of this. Where do you fit in their spectrum of portfolios from least risky to most risky? Portfolio 5 to Portfolio 100. This is important information for you. It's probably the most important information I think you should have about investing. How much risk should you take? Take their risk capacity survey. Some music on this program provided by music.podshow.com. I appreciate your feedback, so send it to me through email at feedback@madmoneymachine.com or call me on the voicemail line. In fact, call and leave a message for show 100 to play at 206-734-4763, or make a comment in the show notes. Visit the website madmoneymachine.com. See you next week.